Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrick's. Joining me today is Brian Hirschman. He's managing partner at Hirschman Capital and a new guest to the show. How are you today, Brian?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to have you. I'd like to get a little bit of your thoughts, or let's say add some color to a quote that ValueWalk said about your fund. They said you're the world's most bearish hedge fund. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. ValueWalk coined that phrase when they published one of my letters in early 2017. And I think there is some truth to the phrase, because I'm bearish not just on U.S. equities, not just on Chinese real estate, not just on U.S. real estate, but all three of those, as well as bonds in most countries. And I think that probably qualifies me as one of the more bearish fund managers out there. On the other hand, though, I recognize that valuations for international equities are getting to be quite reasonable. And certainly, I think some gold mining equities are extremely undervalued. So I'm not bearish on everything, but I am bearish on a lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get to some more of those. A recent study that you published showed that 51 of 52 countries with government debt greater than 130% of GDP have defaulted, and that the U.S. will soon cross that threshold. So tell us more about that study and that market condition that we could see later.
Sure. So U.S. government debt to GDP, if you use IMF projections, is expected to soon be 140%. So I decided that I would look at every situation over the last 200 years or so where government debt had been at a similar level and try to see what had happened to countries that were in a similar situation to what the U.S. currently finds itself in. And what I found was that 51 out of 52 countries with 130% government debt to GDP had defaulted. And that has taken the form of restructuring or devaluation or defaulting through high inflation, as well as through outright default. It's important to remember that countries don't just default by stopping payments on their bonds, but they can also default through leaving a gold standard, abandoning a currency peg, or high inflation. And just to give your listeners some examples, the UK, for example, crossed that 130% debt to GDP threshold after World War I. And then a little while later, it defaulted by abandoning the gold standard. Germany is another good example, which crossed that 130% debt to GDP threshold after World War I, and then consequently experienced hyperinflation in the early 1920s. Another notable example would be Japan, which crossed that threshold during World War II and then subsequently defaulted outright and through inflation during the second half of World War II. And then a more recent example would be Greece, which crossed that 130% threshold after the 2008 financial crisis and then subsequently needed to be bailed out by other countries in Europe. And the only country out of the 52 that I looked at that hasn't defaulted is present-day Japan. And I think for Japan, it's probably just a matter of time, because if Japanese interest rates rise just a few hundred basis points, then Japanese government interest expense is going to be bigger than the entire Japanese government budget. So it seems inevitable that the Japanese bond bubble will have an ugly end, but the exact timing, of course, is difficult to predict. So I think the takeaway for your listeners is that history tells us the U.S. government probably isn't going to be able to get out of its current situation without defaulting through higher inflation. And even though the stock market is still optimistic and is totally ignoring this risk, the bond market also is totally ignoring this risk, I think it could be an incredible opportunity for gold investors and also for the shareholders in smaller gold mining equities like the ones that are owned by my fund.
Absolutely. And one of the dynamics that you write about that I found very fascinating is the dynamic that we currently find ourselves in because of the response to the coronavirus with printing versus borrowing. So you write about basically contrasting printing versus borrowing, so much money that the Fed is trying to borrow to fund its bond purchasing rather than printing it. So tell us a bit more about that distinction of printing versus borrowing.
Sure. I think that's a great question. This is a very important topic, and it kind of amazes me that there's still a lot of misunderstanding about it, even though the Fed has been implementing these policies for more than a decade. And I think the key point for your listeners is, although the press often says that the Fed is printing money to buy bonds, that's really not accurate. In reality, the Fed is actually borrowing to buy assets, and the Fed has done very little money printing. And just to expand on that a little bit, when the Fed implements quantitative easing, and this has been the case since 2008, the Fed issues short-term debt, and that debt takes the form of interest-bearing deposits that banks hold at the Fed, and the Fed pays a high interest rate on those deposits to encourage banks to hold those deposits. So really, what the Fed has been doing since 2008 is executing a highly leveraged carry trade where they borrow short by issuing these deposits, which are also sometimes called excess reserves. And then the Fed uses the cash from that borrowing to invest in higher yielding government bonds and corporate bonds and agency securities. So in a way, the Fed is kind of like a giant hedge fund. And in fact, Warren Buffett a couple years ago actually called the Fed the world's greatest hedge fund for just that reason. And there's a lot of people, I think, that will say that the Fed can keep asset prices high forever just by printing money, but that's totally incorrect. Just as you learned in introductory economics class, if you print money, it causes hyperinflation. And examples of that would be 1920s Germany or Venezuela today. And the Fed realizes that. And so that's why over the last 12 years, they've implemented these bond purchases by borrowing and issuing deposits rather than by printing money. And so I think this next leads us to the question, what happens when we were discussing earlier in the show, the U.S. is likely going to have a debt crisis at some point. And so if that debt crisis happens, what does that mean for the Fed's balance sheet? And this is, it's a complicated topic, but it might be of interest to your listeners. And so if that happens, let's say the U.S. government has a debt crisis, so interest rates spike in the Treasury market. And if the Fed, does nothing and doesn't adjust the interest rate it's paying on its deposits, then the banks that are currently keeping their cash at the Fed in these deposits would then pull their deposits from the Fed and then go invest in the Treasury market or go invest that cash in the economy by making additional loans. And so in that situation where the Fed doesn't raise interest rates in response to a crisis, we would probably end up getting hyperinflation because all these excess reserves, all these deposits that are currently at the Fed would flow into the economy and it would be a massive increase in the money supply. So what the Fed might also try to do is to try to avoid that hyperinflation. The Fed could raise the interest rates on its deposits, and that would encourage banks to keep their money at the Fed, and you wouldn't get the huge increase in the money supply. But if the Fed does that, then its carry trade becomes enormously unprofitable because the Fed would still be getting a relatively low interest rate on its bond portfolio, but then it would now be paying a super high interest rate on its deposits. So the Fed would be bleeding cash, for lack of a better term. And that hole would have to be plugged by the Treasury, which would require the government to issue more debt at a time that the U.S. government might already be having a tough time issuing debt. So the Fed has implemented this gigantic carry trade. It's kind of worked so far. But what I'm trying to show and explain is that if the U.S. government has a debt crisis, the Fed's carry trade could quickly fall apart and the Fed could be left with a number of very unattractive options where it keeps interest rates low and causes hyperinflation, or it raises interest rates on its deposits, but then that causes massive losses on the Fed's bond portfolio. So neither one of those would really be very appealing to the Fed But what we can say with more certainty is that if that situation arises, it should be incredibly positive for gold and also probably for gold mining equities, since hyperinflation would probably cause people to rush from bonds to gold, and anything that makes it look like the U.S. government is going to have a very bad debt crisis would also increase investor demand for gold.
And as you say, Brian, it's a tough topic to really explain easily. But in your most recent letter, your half-year letter, let's say, you say that the Fed will need to raise interest rates on its deposits to match spiking treasury yields, and hyperinflation would result as the banks redeem their federal deposits and lend them to the economy. So are the spiking treasury yields the same as the spiking bonds?
Yes. So in that situation, we're saying investors wake up from their stupor and realize that the U.S. government can't pay the debts that it's borrowed. And so as a result, they demand a higher interest rate in the treasury market, as well as the results they would also need. And as a result, the Fed would also need to pay a higher interest rate on the deposits that banks are holding at the Fed, because that's really debt issued by the Fed, and the Fed is part of the U.S. government. So when the required interest rate for lending to the federal government and the treasury market goes up, then the rate that banks need to get on their deposits out of the Fed would also go up.
Brian, this brings another question to my mind about how the banks are quote unquote lending to the economy, and we're not necessarily seeing that right now. So can you explain to me a little bit about how the Fed is paying a higher interest rate and then how the banks aren't necessarily really lending that money into the economy right now? And I guess a piece of that would be, even though interest rates are low right now, lending standards are actually tight.
Sure. Yeah, banks are always trying to optimize their risk-adjusted return on capital while complying with regulations. And right now, the Fed is paying a higher risk-adjusted return on its excess reserves, on its deposits, than banks could get by investing in the treasury market or by lending the funds out in the private loan market. So as a result, banks are keeping their cash at the Fed in these deposits. They're not earning much, but they're earning a better risk-adjusted return than they could get in any of these other markets. And they're also, of course, considering the regulatory impact of reserves, of holding cash at the Fed, which is very favorable compared to making loans. And this, of course, means that by implementing these policies, the Fed has shifted capital in the banking sector from the private loan market to deposits at the Fed. And so there probably is some crowding out that has gone on there, where cash is being lent to the Fed, to the U.S. government, and it otherwise would have been lent to the private sector. And so all this means that if something were to happen where the risk-adjusted return the banks were getting on their deposits at the Fed was no longer as attractive, then banks might pull their cash from the Fed and then lend it to the private sector. And that's when we could see a big increase in the money supply and a big increase in inflation.
One of the other things that bulls often argue is that the U.S. government won't have a crisis because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world and they've paid off the debt since World War II. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. I think those are two. It's a great question, since those are two of the more common bull arguments I hear as to why investors should not worry about the very high levels of U.S. government debt. And the first argument that people make is they say, oh, the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency, therefore inflation is going to stay low and interest rates are always going to stay low. But that argument makes no sense to me, because in the 1970s, during the U.S. Great Inflation, it was also true that the U.S. dollar was the world's reserve currency. Yet that didn't stop inflation expectations from exploding higher during the 1970s. And that didn't stop U.S. government interest rates from reaching 16% in 1981. So if our reserve currency status didn't prevent that inflation crisis, it seems highly unlikely that it's going to prevent the next one. Another common argument that people make is that because the U.S. had a high debt burden after World War II and was able to eventually reduce it, they say that we shouldn't be worried about the U.S. government's current debt situation. But that argument, I think, is just as absurd as the reserve currency argument. For one, the U.S. didn't just pay down its debt after World War II. It actually defaulted through higher inflation. And between 1946 and 1948, inflation actually totaled 34%. And I think in the current market environment, if we had 34% inflation over the next 2 or 3 years, it would spark chaos. So I don't think that that's much of an argument for why things are going to stay calm. Another big difference versus between now and the period after World War II is that after World War II, the U.S. government was able to shut off most of its defense spending. And as a result, it went from running huge deficits to running extremely large budget surpluses, for example, 3% in 1948. And so that helped the government debt to GDP come down in the years after World War II. Now, in contrast, because Medicare and Social Security aren't going anywhere, the U.S. government is expected to run budget deficits as far as the eye can see. And that's even if you're making very rosy assumptions about GDP growth and interest rates. So our situation now is much worse than it was after World War II. And even despite the budget surplus situation after World War II, we still defaulted through higher inflation. So what happened after World War II, that shouldn't make you optimistic about the U.S. government's current situation, but it should probably make you optimistic about gold and gold mining equities.
So, Brian, in your opinion, how bad might the next crisis be? Again, you write about we could see a global government debt crisis that pops China's debt bubble, U.S. equities, and also U.S. real estate. And I think one of the key pieces of data that blew my mind in regards to China's debt bubble was that China has used more cement in the last 2 years than the U.S. did in the entire 20th century. And further, its issuing of $7 of debt per dollar of GDP growth. That just blows my mind to think about those types of numbers. So tell us a little bit more about the world debt crisis and how bad that next crisis could be.
Yeah, it's a great question. We are truly living in unprecedented times. Not only do we have unsustainable government debt in the U.S., but government debt in many other countries is also at very dangerous levels. For example, Brazil, for example, Japan, which we talked about earlier, UK government debt is very high, Eurozone government debt is extremely high. And it's not just the Fed that is implementing this reckless carry trade. The BOJ and the ECB are essentially implementing the same kind of aggressive carry trade. And on top of that, we have China, which in the Chinese real estate market is arguably the world's most important asset class, as Jim Chanos has said, because of its sheer size. And although Chinese growth has slowed recently, there are still major imbalances in that economy in terms of borrowing, in terms of all the overinvestment in infrastructure, and in terms of just the general overcapacity. And so we could have a situation where the U.S. government bond market has a crisis, and that in turn spreads to the Eurozone government bond market, and that in turn pops the Chinese real estate bubble, and at the same time, the U.S. equity bubble bursts, and at the same time, the U.S. real estate bubble bursts, because all of these bubbles are in some way benefiting from lower interest rates. So if we do get that interest rate spike, you could very easily see a lot of different bubbles unravel at the same time. And if that happened, it could potentially make the first half of 2020 seem uneventful by comparison. And you don't have to take my word for it. Jim Rogers has said something similar, that he expects the next bear market to be the worst of his lifetime due to the record level of debt that we have across the globe. One analogy that I used in a previous letter that I got from Mark Spitznagel of Universal Investments is that U.S. economic policy, global economic policy, is like a discredited firefighting policy. What do I mean by that? So it used to be the policy in the U.S. for most of the 20th century that whenever there was a forest fire, it would be suppressed as quickly as possible, even if it was a small fire. But over time, people learned that that was not such a good idea because it led to a buildup of tinder. And so when there inevitably was a forest fire, it was far worse than it otherwise would have been. And an example of that would be the 1988 Yellowstone fire, which burned 44 times more land than any previous recorded fire at Yellowstone. But economic policymakers haven't learned that lesson. And so for the past 30, 40 years, every time there's been a minor economic crisis, they've tried to suppress it as quickly as possible with bailouts or with deficit spending or with monetary stimulus, such as lower interest rates. And the examples go on and on. You had the rate cuts after the 87 stock market crash. You had the rate cuts after the 91 recession. You had the stimulus and rate cuts after the 2000 dot-com crash. You had the bailouts of the savings and loan sector in the 1980s and 1990s. You had the bailout of Mexico in 1994. You had the bailout of long-term capital management in 1998. You guys get the idea. And the problem with this is just as suppressing forest fires leads to a buildup of tinder, suppressing all these crises leads to a buildup of debt in the system because investors and borrowers become more reckless, because they think that the government is always going to be there to bail them out. And you can see that in kind of global debt to GDP ratios. For most of the last two centuries, they were around 120% global debt to GDP. And here we're talking about private and public debt. We're not just talking about government debt. But over the last few decades, as governments have gotten really aggressive about suppressing every little crisis, the global debt to GDP has risen to close to 250%, so far greater than the historical average. Now we're in this very interesting and potentially dangerous situation, because for the last 30 to 40 years, governments have always kind of been there to step in and try to bail out the private sector whenever there was a crisis. They've tried to suppress it as much as they can. But now, as we were talking about earlier in the show, government debt is kind of, it's getting to the breaking point. It's getting to the point where default seems virtually certain. So in the next crisis, although people are expecting the government to bail them out again, it may be that actually the government is the source of the crisis. And people, the investors that have been accustomed to interest rates always falling, are going to get a shock, because if the government is having a debt crisis, it's not going to be able to bail out the private sector. It's not going to be able to cut interest rates. In fact, interest rates would probably spike. It's not going to be able to implement a massive fiscal stimulus. In fact, it'll probably have to implement austerity. So what you might have, instead of getting a government bailout, is you might have a debt spiral where a government debt crisis causes the private sector's growth to slow, and then the slower private sector growth in turn makes the government debt crisis worse. So all these years of crisis suppression may have created the seeds for a very difficult situation. But that should be, again, incredibly positive for gold and for gold mining equities.
Yeah, and you also write about when these bubble burst, it will unleash the mother of all gold rallies. So how high could we see the gold price go? And what are some of the best ways for investors to protect themselves in this situation by buying gold?
Sure. So I think there's a lot of good reasons to think that the next inflation crisis will be even worse than the 1970s. Great inflation. But to be conservative, if we just assume that gold goes back to its 1980 valuation, then that would imply that the US dollar gold price should go above $6,000. If the crisis is much worse, it's possible it'll go higher. But we're value investors, so we're probably not going to hang on for the last dollar. But I think $6,000 is a good target price for where gold might go in a crisis. And then as far as the best way for investors to protect themselves against a potential inflation crisis or government debt crisis, I think Berkshire Hathaway recently told us with their Barrick Gold investment that they think gold miners are probably a better trade than buying a gold ETF. And that makes sense, because you get positive free cash flow with a gold miner investment, and you get a call option on a gold miner's undeveloped gold ounces and their exploration assets. And for a gigantic firm such as Berkshire, Barrick may have been the best option. But I think if any of your listeners are smaller investors, there's probably better opportunities. And those are the small yet still high quality gold mining equities that are undervalued solely because they aren't eligible for gold mining ETFs. And I'll explain that a little bit more. Most of the gold mine investors tend to buy the ETF because it's highly liquid and it's very simple. You don't have to worry about analyzing every individual mine and every individual management team. But I think that good idea has been taken a bit too far. As a result, the gold mining equities that are in the ETFs are trading at outrageous multiples relative to the gold mining equities that aren't eligible for the ETF. And in some cases, the smaller companies are trading at 1/10 of the multiple of companies like Barrick that are eligible for the ETF. And these smaller companies, they often have good margins, great mine life, very good exploration potential. They're in very safe jurisdictions. They have good management. So you can effectively buy something similar to what Berkshire is buying for 1/10 of the valuation. You don't need to be a hedge fund manager to realize that's probably a pretty good trade. And that valuation disparity that we see right now between larger gold mining equities and the companies outside the ETF, that should go away over time because these smaller companies should get acquired, or the smaller companies might merge to become eligible for the ETF, or a company might go from being a developer to a producer and that'll make it eligible for the ETF. And another way to think about this is the valuations on these smaller mines are so low that I can often assume a gold price of only $1,300 or $1,250, and they're still trading at massive discounts to their future cash flows. So with these orphaned companies outside the ETF, you have a level of downside protection that I don't think you get from the gold ETF or from the gold mining ETF. And unfortunately, most gold mutual funds, they're too big to kind of capitalize on that kind of opportunity. My fund is smaller, so we're able to invest in these smaller securities. And so that's one of the reasons why I think we're extremely likely to crush the gold mining ETF over the next 6 years, as we have over the last 6 years or so.
Very interesting, Brian. There's another question that comes to mind as you're talking about some of these smaller miners and stuff. And it's also part of your strategy of value investing. So how do you go about determining what the intrinsic value of these miners or producers are? What are some of the factors that you take into consideration when looking at the valuation of these companies?
Sure. Our intrinsic value calculations aren't that complicated. We look at companies' valuations in a number of different ways. But one way to think about it is we're making a projection of the mine's future gold production, and then we're making a conservative assumption about the gold price. And then that gives us our revenue projection from the gold mine. And then we're making a conservative assumption about what the mine's operating costs are likely to be. And so combining those, that gives us our expected future cash flow from the mining project. And then we're discounting that back at a very conservative rate. And so there are a few proprietary things that we do when we're estimating production and we're estimating costs and things like that. But that's basically the gist of it. And I think our advantage is, you know, we run a very concentrated portfolio, so we're only investing in kind of the 10 or 15 names that are most undervalued, so we can be pretty selective and only invest in situations where we can make these really conservative assumptions and the securities still look very undervalued and are still trading at huge discounts to the present value of their future cash flows. And some of the reasons that exist, I mentioned earlier, is these many of these companies are outside the ETF and have been orphaned and don't have the same kind of buying demand that securities in the ETF have.
Excellent, Brian. Well, as we wrap up, do you have any concluding thoughts?
No, I think that's it. One thing I wanted to mention that I forgot to mention earlier is when we were talking about the Federal Reserve, you know, I was going to make the point that you don't have to take my word for it. You can listen to Warren Buffett also. And at his recent annual meeting, he made the point that if countries could issue unlimited amounts of debt at negative interest rates, it would have been discovered many years ago, not just now. And to me, that was Buffett's kind of subtle way of saying that if central banks could always keep interest rates low, no government would ever default. But governments default all the time. So of course, we know that central banks are not omnipotent and they're not going to be able to prevent every crisis. And if you look at 2020 alone, you had defaults in Argentina, Ecuador, Lebanon, even though they all had central banks. So that obviously tells us that central banks can't solve every crisis. And there's lots of examples of history where central banks in wealthy countries have also been overwhelmed. We had the 1970s U.S. Great Inflation, which the Fed wasn't able to prevent. You had Iceland's crisis in 2008 when its central bank couldn't prevent that country's financial crisis. You had the 2015 Swiss currency peg collapse when the Swiss central bank couldn't keep the currency pegged at that level. So I think the biggest misconception in markets right now is that central banks can always control asset prices. And once investors realize that that's false, then it should be incredibly positive for gold.
Great, Brian. We can find more information about you and your fund at H Capital LLC on Twitter, and hcapital.llc is your website, correct?
Correct.
Excellent, Brian. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Tom. It was great to speak with you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?